Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TeamCast. I am Dr. Preston Klein, Director of Research and Education at the Mission Critical Team Institute. The TeamCast is a show where my colleagues discuss all things mission critical teams. Mission critical teams are teams of 4 to 12 people who are indigenously trained and educated and who solve rapidly emerging complex adaptive problem sets. MCTs work in immersive environments of 300 seconds or less where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. Regardless of whether you are a mission critical team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the TeamCast.
G'day. My name's Harry Moffat. Today on the TeamCast, I speak with Dave Robson, who is currently the chief engineer for Williams Formula One racing team. Dave has spent almost all of his adult life in Formula One racing, and between 15 years with McLaren and 11 with Williams, he's worked his way from a performance and race engineer all the way to the top of his game as one of the most respected F1 engineers and chief engineers in the business. He talks about leadership, he talks about teams, and he also talks about the tension between data and intuition. I love this discussion. I hope you do too. Well, thanks very much for joining us, mate. It's nice and early there, I think.
It is, yeah, 7:30 in the morning. But great to see you again, Harry.
Yeah, you too, mate. And I appreciate you coming on. I've been looking forward to this one for a couple of months now because we've been chasing each other. You've been back into the swing of things in the Formula One world. Just for the listeners, I've had the pleasure of meeting you and visiting the facilities out there. But just for the listeners, just if you can give a brief outline of your work in and around the F1 industry and where you find yourself now.
Yeah, sure. So this is actually my 25th year now, I think, in Formula One. So since I graduated in 2000, this is all I've really known. I had some previous industrial experience before that, but since I left university, I've been in Formula One. I did 14 years, first 14 years with McLaren. Initially in the design office, doing structural stress work, and then during that 3 or 4 years, I got an opportunity to go to the track. Back then, we used to have test teams, so there was a whole mirror of the race team who would go around, typically around Europe, with separate cars doing testing. And it was a fantastic way to learn. And that first time I went to the track just blew me away about how everything was organized and just it's just brilliant. Anyway, I then got a chance to apply for a job there on the test team at McLaren. I successful at the second attempt. Did that for a couple of years, and then,
when you say the test team, what's that differentiated? But
yeah, so unfortunately, it's not something we do anymore. But we used to have the race team, so the race engineers, mechanics, drivers who would go around and do the races, the Grand Prix that you see on the TV, and then we almost had a completely mirror image of that team, a whole separate team who had their own cars. Typically, their own test drivers, although the race drivers would come along as well. And we would typically go around circuits in Europe between the Grand Prix and test things. So either test the car, test some different tyres. So it was a whole enormous operation back then doing this track testing work. So that was where I really cut my teeth. And say the fact that we don't have that anymore in current F1 is really tricky in the sense that it's very hard to train people ultimately to go on the race team. So I was very fortunate. I got that opportunity and I did that testing work for 2 or 3 years before I got kind of called up to the race team proper, if you like. And then I did that for another 7 or 8 years, I think, at McLaren, engineering the car, ultimately being Jenson Button's race engineer for several seasons. Right. And then, 10 years ago now, I moved from McLaren to Williams, carried on race engineering, then with Felipe Massa. And then I've, over the last three or four years, I've worked my way up into chief race engineer. So I ran the trackside engineering team at the races, and then took on the role of head of vehicle performance. So incorporating that running of the race team or the race engineering team, but also getting more involved in specifying the car and ultimately trying to make the car faster. And that's led to where I am now, where I'm one of two chief engineers here at Williams. So I'm a bit more factory based now than I used to be. And the two of us effectively alternate in responsibility for cars, so by different seasons. So I'm working on the current car and I'm about to start work on what will be our 2027 car. And then there's another chief engineer working on next year's car. So that's how we're kind of organized now.
That's great. When we came out to Williams there, we were talking a little bit about apprenticeships. And it's a model that we're researching at the Mission Critical Team Institute. So that sounds like the perfect way to grow engineers and build, you know, all of the reps and all of the knowledge that you need. What do you do now if the testing part of the business is no longer? How do you build people?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's incredibly difficult. It was much more straightforward when we had that parallel team, that opportunity, as you say, to get in the reps and to understand just how the trackside team works, because it's not necessarily a natural environment for you know, new young graduate engineers, say, who engineers typically tend to like dealing in black and white and ones and zeros. Everything, you know, needs to be right and correct and fully analyzed. But of course, the reality of the trackside environment with the time constraints is you don't have time to do that. So yeah, how you teach people to take that academic knowledge that they have and learn to apply it in a way that is quite restricted either by regulations or, as I say, by the time constraints is quite difficult. So there are things we can do back here at base. We can simulate the environment either by using the simulator where there's actually a driver driving the car. And that's mainly an engineering tool, but again, you can use it to train some people in terms of applying a time pressure, and you can recreate the practice sessions and ultimately qualifying and the race that like we do at the track. We can use the ops room and kind of simulate parts of the race weekend and at least put people under a little bit of artificial pressure and see how they react. But the truth is there's no easy way. So we tend to rotate people in maybe on Fridays at the race weekend when we have the practice sessions, we can bring some of the more junior engineers and give them some experience. But it's much more difficult than it used to be. And when they eventually have to sit in the hot seat, it can be really difficult and a really make or break.
Yeah, I when I visited the pits at Melbourne last year or the year before, you just had an incident, which I imagine is impossible to simulate. You'd had a car basically written off. Yeah, so was that, you know, is your first time trackside for some of those young guys in the team, men and women in the team?
Yeah, for something like that, then yeah, it is. And it's interesting how we operate in the environment. I'm sure as you and all the listeners know, we can have sort of SOPs, if you like. We can have standard procedures for covering off certain incidents, but they're only a guide, and those novices might sit there and read all of those SOPs, but you know how it is. The reality is you've got a great plan right up until something you didn't expect happens, and it's just really difficult to deal with.
Well, I want to come back to that because I've got some questions here around how we build intuition. You know, even in the most intuitive endeavors of humans, they have the opposite problems, say in football or sports, like football, where it's all intuitive. You could argue, how do they merge the data? And it's kind of the other way around. But I'll just take a step back, mate. Just for those who imagine what the pits are like, and it's got to be one of the most, you know, high-level sporting environments to be in, very, very ritzy and glamorous. But just talk us through, so what I was seeing when I first went in there, we've got a couple of cars and a team of people. Just explain what the makeup is, if you wouldn't mind. So we've got an idea of the team on race day that you're managing and overseeing.
Yeah, okay. So at the race, we're limited by the number of people that we can take who are sort of operational on the car, so that's a regulation. So there are 60 operational people, as you say, split across two cars. So each team enters two cars into the race. So that immediately gives you an interesting sporting dynamic, because for the driver, their main competitor is actually their teammate. So, you know, inevitably they want to beat their teammate because they're the only other driver they know is in the same equipment with the same opportunity. But at the same time, they have to work together to lift the whole bar. And that creeps into the engineering team as well. So we...
That's a really...
Yeah, so of those 60 people, maybe we have about 15 engineers And then there are 35 or so mechanics, technicians who are actually building the car and all their subsystems. But those engineers that in the past have worked for me, we've probably got 4 dedicated to each car, working for that driver, solely focused on that car. And then another 7 or 8 specialist engineers, the tire expert, the aerodynamic expert, and so on. And that team of people look after both cars. And so there's a lot of interaction. And it's not totally unlike the sort of swarming of teams that I know you talked about on these podcasts. Yep. In the past, and particularly in the sort of medical field. Obviously, there are major differences, but it is a little bit like that. All those specialist engineers, when the car isn't on the track, literally on the track, they're all very focused on their own speciality, and then they all have something to bring to the party, and that all has to be combined into a run plan. And so the engineers dedicated to each car, who all ultimately work for the race engineer. So the race engineer owns the car, if you like, owns the room, and they will get all of these ideas submitted to them, and it's their job to work out how we actually pick and choose from all those interesting things we'd like to do and fit them into a program in the time we've got. So this, for example, is in the practice sessions. But equally in the race, it applies. The tire person wants us to slow down and look after the tire so they last, but the strategy team know we need to keep pushing on. We've got to keep, if we slow down now, then the race is over anyway. So bringing all of this together whilst nursing the health of the car is a really difficult job. And that's where we kind of need the race engineer on each car to take all those inputs and almost be the center of this wheel. They've got all of these things they could do, but not enough time to do everything, or some things contradict each other, and they've got to turn that into a one coherent plan and tell the driver, who's in some crazy emotional state out on track, that this is what the plan is, and this is how the driver needs to be involved to execute it.
There must be, are there times for you and the leadership on the track, and is there a time for you where you wish the bloody human would get out of the car and it could just, your bias is towards, wow, your emotions are with the car? Is that the right question to ask? I don't even know.
No, I mean, it's fascinating, because I think, again, if you, from a pure engineering science point of view, the driver is a massive inconvenience, because they do have that emotional state. They are risking themselves. If what they do is phenomenally difficult, they are serious sports people, and people who maybe just kind of come in and out of Formula One don't fully appreciate just how fit and talented those guys are. So in some ways, as an engineer, it'd be nice to get rid of them, but actually it's they are what makes the sport for me interesting. I don't want to go racing video games or robots. That it's dealing with that emotion, dealing with the person, and getting that whole relationship between the person and the machine is fascinating. And it's one of those things that the trackside engineers, particularly when they're young and inexperienced, they need to learn to deal with, because it's not normal engineering necessarily. There is this whole emotional part, and you've got to link the data you can see, you've got to link it to what the driver's telling you, what they're feeling, and then process that and turn that. That's where some intuition comes into it. We've got all sorts of simulations that will help, but simulating a driver is incredibly difficult. And so it's, for me, it's what makes it interesting. And once you accept that and learn to embrace it, then it's what turns us into a sport ultimately. That engineering meeting sport, and it's brilliant.
Fascinating. And I see so much to learn in military contexts. The military is kind of struggling with this, and struggling is probably not the right word. They're coming to grips with this at the moment. That the humans that are out on the ground are being overloaded and overwhelmed with equipment and tracking devices and biofeedback and more communications and location devices. And now we've got heads up displays for soldiers on the ground so they can see each other through buildings and walls. And the cognitive overload is something, I think, there is a tension between the science and tech people and the human factor, I suppose. And so I see a lot to be learned there. also, again, going back to that sporting analogy where there's the think about football, we go back to talk about football, where does the blame for the injuries lie? Does it lie with the people who are trying to protect the player, take the player off now they've run enough kilometres, and the coach is going, what do you mean? He just kicked 5 goals, we need him out there.
Yeah.
And so that tension, the human tech interface, just pick apart a bit more about, you know, the people that you train, select, et cetera. How do you make that balance between a great black and white engineer and an intuitive decision maker, that balance?
Yeah. As you touched on, it is incredibly difficult to understand how people will react to that situation. And for some people, it becomes quite natural. And for others, I think it just sort of will never quite work. It just never suits them. The trackside environment, I think you either love it or you hate it. So trying to pick individuals who we think might have that aptitude is tough, but we can look for people who have a sporting background. That always helps, because almost naturally, without knowing it, they've got a bit of that.
Okay.
But you just can't beat the experience. You've got to let people have the time. And I think for us to kind of grow the team, we have to just have all that shared experience, and you have to give people that opportunity. And yes, they might trip over a few times, but so long as they learn from that, then that's all okay. And they've got to, I think, to be able to deal with that overload of information, you just ultimately got to have some confidence that you can just back away from it and not get lost in it. And as I say, when the car's out on track, the session finishes in 30 minutes or whatever it is, then that's that. It doesn't wait for you. We run to this very rigid time plan, which again is unusual for a lot of people. For me, I think it's brilliant. I like that little bit of pressure. But you have to then be able to say, all right, I've got this amount of data, I don't have time to go through it in all the detail I'd like. I just have to step back, almost just close my eyes, take one big deep breath and say, right, given the few things I can process now and given the help I get from some simulation I've got going on over here, which is using that live data and trying to turn it into genuine information for me, what is the best thing I can do? And I get very stressed.
That's so well put, mate. That's brilliantly put.
That, yeah, thanks. I think you just have to learn that experience, I think, to be able to understand how to do it. And then when it gets tough, I close my eyes and think, well, look, ultimately what we're doing is a sport. So all I have to do is be a little bit better than the other 9 or 10 teams. They're all in the same boat. They have the same sort of equivalent information, limited time. Everything is the same. So stop worrying about, the inconveniences of the regulations or the driver and all of that. Just say, well, we're in the same boat as these other 9 or 10 people. All I have to do is do things a little bit better than they do, and I will win. I will be successful. So that for me, kind of, and maybe you can say it's a kind of coping strategy, but it kind of allows me just to relax and say, well, yeah, why? There's no reason why they should be any better than I am. And if it is, it's because they've got a bit more experience or they've got better tools, and I need to work on that later. But right here, right now, we're all equal, and so I can make my decision with confidence and hope they're the ones unable to make a decision.
Yeah, I love that. You put it really well, mate. It's the struggle to articulate what intuition is. And in a way, when you do articulate it and give it language, it kind of undermines what intuitiveness is. It's a very natural thing. There's a saying, or I've heard it put, that situational awareness, which is a bit of a buzzword in the military and elsewhere, you can't know what it is. It's impossible to explain it. It's just something you experience. And the way you captured it was this kind of just step back, and almost sounds like mysticism, step back and use the vibe, use the force. But
yeah,
but that's real. That is absolutely real. And I think we sometimes with our younger operators, we're in danger of not allowing them that ability to zoom in and out, to kind of go back and go, okay, I've got everything I can possibly have. What's my inner intuition, innate or intuition telling me, and then going for it, because that's the rep, in a way.
Yeah, I think you're right, and it's the first time you have to do it. You have to do it for real. It's not easy, but again, you kind of, once you accept that that's the position you're in, and you've got to take some action. And actually, the worst thing you can do now is do nothing.
Yeah.
Then you kind of. You learn to do it. I think what's interesting is whether that is something people are born with effectively, or whether it's something you really can train. There are aspects about what we might consider to be high performance that maybe I've always thought myself were kind of coping strategies because I wasn't high performance, and I actually took a great deal of pleasure in reading something in your book, actually, the 11 Bats book, where you talk about high performance, and there's this myth that high performance people just innately deal well under pressure, and actually it's not that. It's all the planning and the training and all of the attention to detail beforehand, and I think for me that is also crucial, and that's something I've always done, I think, but I always felt I was doing it because to make up for the fact I couldn't work under pressure naturally. So actually reading what you said in your book, and I think the other great bit about that is the bit that says, if you do all of that preparation, when things go wrong and you're faced with a situation you didn't plan for, you'll feel much more confident about dealing with it and dealing with that uncertainty. Yeah. And that's exactly how I've always felt and always behaved. So now the question for me is that something you're effectively born with, or you have that kind of approach through your formative years, and when you arrive to us or to any of the other teams, is that already formed? And then is that, and if you have that ability and that just sense of how to go about things, does that give you the intuition as well? Or I don't know. And if that's true, then maybe in our selection process, how do I assess people for that? And I assume if they into all that prep and planning, will they have everything else that I need?
Yeah, it's a great question that many people who are listening will have uttered themselves. And I think that one area I really like to explore and look at is just tolerance for ambiguity. And we test for that. Most militaries do, and I think a lot of high performing environments do as well. I've seen it called character. I'm not sold too much on how you test for character, but certainly people who maybe they come from a higher risk environment or tolerance for risk environment where their parents let them free, I don't know, but it's the nature nurture question. I'm sure we'll keep dancing around that because that's of high interest to us in research that Preston's doing at the moment, that he's actually focused on personally on adaptive learning and all of the human factors around that. You said something interesting off air that at the moment you're rebuilding a new car or a new team, or you're resetting everything from last time round. So was I right in assuming that the real question there is, when you're building a team and a car at the same time, what are some of the challenges in both or bringing them together that you've had?
Yeah. So yeah, that's the two main parts of what we do, I guess, is we build the team, and that's the factory team is just as high performance, but in a slightly different way to the trackside team. But that's massively important part of what we do. And then at the same time, we've got to develop the cars themselves. They have to be fundamentally quick, whatever that kind of means in an engineering sense, but they have to be fast, otherwise everything else is kind of doesn't really help very much, and we won't be successful. Now, in terms of the cars and the regulations, then we're in the middle of the season at the moment. The season will end in December, and then we kick off again next spring. And we, as a sport, we're having an enormous regulation change for next year. So the impact of back on the team at the factory, particularly who are currently doing all the research for that new car, you come up against the same things because the regulations are, as an engineer, they're just a massive inconvenience. They stop you from doing all the things you'd like to do that would make it relatively easy to make the car quick. And they do that because we want it to be a sport. We want the drivers to be the big heroes, which is is quite right. We also want to do it to constrain costs and to keep it, to keep all the teams relatively close. So it is a good sport and a good spectacle. But obviously, say as an engineer just trying to make a fast car, they're a pain, the regulations. But again, one of the things you have to do when you're in that process is accept that they are the regulations. They're the same for everyone. Don't let them annoy and frustrate you, because that's not helpful. So it is a fascinating time at the moment. We've got the engineering challenge of that new car, but say that the team responsible for that has to get into this high performance mindset about how we deal with the regulations, how we use the resource we've got at the factory. We can't just test everything we'd like to do in the wind tunnel or in the simulation, or we've got to make some decisions. Again, you need to make them without perfect information, because if we sit and wait until we've got all the perfect information, we're just behind. Yeah. And that's for an engineer, that's a really stressful situation to be in. If you're designing an aircraft or a civil engineering project, it obviously must be safe, must be economical and so on. And so you have to spend that time doing all of that analysis, doing all the testing. We can't do that because we just get behind our competitors. So we've got to find ways of shortcutting. And we want to do that led by the data as much as possible. But there are times when you just need a little bit of intuition, and that's what will advance the program and get you ahead of your rivals. So we're in a really fascinating period at the moment, racing the current car, trying to do as well as we can in the championship, but also preparing for this massive regulation hit that will hit us next season.
You've got I imagine on race day, or when you come up to a race, you've got a way that you want to race the car where it's what you might consider normal. So we're just kind of racing the car, and then there's times when you need to really dial it up and extend the risk, if you will. Yeah. And at times you break that. As when I visited the pits, what's the emotion around the pits when you know you're pushing and redlining really hard? I'm speaking naively here, I know, but you're second or third, and there's a chance to earn some points, etc. What are the emotions like around it in the Williams team, without giving too much away to the competition? But
the emotions when the car is in a strong position, you inevitably start to think about all the things that could go wrong. And how do I try and manage them? And the problem with that is you can often overthink it and end up doing something silly. And equally, if you're in a strong position, but there's an opportunity potentially to do something better, then as you say, how hard do you want to push the car and the driver and push into a slightly higher risk zone and hope that you get a better finish as a result? Now,
have you got any races that come to mind where you've felt, oh, geez, we're on the edge here? They've come in, it's flown in on one wing or something.
There's a couple of those, and I see it from both sides. It was a race I did when I was with McLaren still, with Jensen in Japan, in Suzuka, and we were leading the race with, I thought, I don't know, maybe 10 laps to go, and quite clearly there's not much fuel left in the car. Now, yep. That's an interesting one, because it's easy to say, well, running out of fuel is just a silly rookie error. But equally, if you say that, then people have a tendency to put way too much fuel in the car, which is just mass, and that just slows you down enormously. So you've got to get it right. Yep. You can't just be conservative. So, with 10 laps to go, you're starting to run out of fuel. Well, you've got to say, well, look, we're in this position and we're leading the race in part because we haven't carried the weight that maybe some of the others have done in the previous 40 laps or whatever it is. But we now need to manage this, and it's difficult. In that particular race, we started managing it, so we've got to get onto the driver. The worst thing for them is to hear they need to start slowing down and coasting through the braking and saving fuel. They hate that. It spoils their rhythm. They can see in their mirrors the guy behind catching up. So we have to negotiate that with Jensen. You've got to explain what the situation is, and it starts to get a bit hairy. And how much do I trust the sensors on the car that tell me exactly what's left? And in the end, we we saved and saved, and the cars behind got really close. And then the last couple of laps, we just say, well, we're going shit or bust here, and we just turn it back up, get back onto Jensen and say, just go. We think it'll be okay. And we crossed the line, won the race, and then immediately stopped the car. and in Suzuka, normally the cars would do an in lap, you know, they would drive slowly back around the track, come back to the pits, and the drivers would get out. But we had to stop the car early, which back then you were allowed to do. And it's a huge downhill after you cross the line in Suzuka as well. So Jensen got out of the car started rolling. So take the steering wheel off and use it to sort of chop the front wheel. And then he had to run back along the pit lane. So that's a good example of how you've just got to decide, do we want to play safe and get second or third here? Or do we, how much do we trust the tools and how much are we prepared to let this backfire? Because sometimes it will. And then you come into one of the other massive difficulties we have sometimes with the trackside team or the whole team. But you have to be resilient because not the whole world, but millions of people are watching this. Yeah. And if you get it wrong, you can look pretty silly. And the media feedback and social media these days can be pretty brutal when you make what looks like a really obvious mistake. But the reality is everything we do is trading some level of risk and reward.
In the training and the simulation that you use with the team, how much of your time do you spend on crisis and kind of this redlining in the training realm compared to just business as usual and testing?
Yes, it's a really good question. I think a lot of it inevitably is business as usual, but we kind of know, and we do try and help people understand that business as usual in itself comes with an awful lot of uncertainty. So going back to the planning, I do encourage people to plan for almost any situation that might arise. And yeah, you might look back and think some of that was a waste of time and I didn't need to do it. But as you say, it prepares you, or at least it certainly prepares me for dealing with that uncertainty. And so a lot of sort of learning to deal with the crises that might happen, the sort of edge cases, the things when, or the times when things don't go as you intended, that all comes from all of the planning and the preparation. And I think not for every specific event, but just to equip yourself with the confidence and the tools and the information to be able to deal with whatever crops up. So training for that, still very, very difficult, but we try like standard operating procedures. We have quite a few of those for different things that might crop up, but inevitably you could write so many of those that people would never remember them all anyway.
No, that's right. Yeah, contingency plans for contingency plans.
Exactly.
What about they say that planning for the next mission starts with the reflection on the last mission.
Yeah.
If you do have a crisis or you do have something that doesn't go so well, you know, what point and what procedures or what process do you apply to reflection?
Yeah, so we do run an after action review kind of process, or actually several of them, looking at different aspects. So might be one around the communications on the radio, particularly with the driver. So that kind of thing will go on, and that is an ongoing process, and things that people involved will obviously learn from directly and apply immediately to the next race, the next mission. Some of it when more unusual events have cropped up. So for us, for example, when it starts raining, that changes everything.
Yeah.
And you can definitely plan to some extent for the rain, but it's very hard to predict exactly how much rain is going to fall and when. So you can't just say, it's raining, this is the sort of number of millimeters per hour, therefore this is what I do, and that's set in stone. So instead we have a wet sort of SOP, but it's much more about setting the tone. It tries to set the intent, and it slightly, we redefine everyone's job a little bit, because a lot of the things that are worth the marginal gains in the dry conditions. So going back to the sort of specialist engineers, they might have a switch change they want to make, which will make a couple of milliseconds of performance gain. And they're reading that off the data and they can see that that would be advantageous. But in the wet, it just doesn't matter. You don't want to interrupt what the driver's doing just to make a switch change for a few milliseconds, because it can completely throw them in the wet. And they are, for the first time, so when they're driving in the dry, they have so much capacity, the drivers, to think and do other things and understand everything that's going on around them. But in the wet, driving the car typically takes their entire bandwidth. So as engineers, we've got to say, well, okay, all of these things that were important, they're just not anymore. So we repurpose those engineers. Don't do what you normally do. For you, you've got a different role now, or in the wet. So for that kind of situation, say it's quite a general operating procedure, but I think it's reasonably well written, that it sets the tone and the expectation, but it's ultimately kind of trying to set the team up as well as possible to use their intuition in that situation.
Yeah, so I imagine you just said a couple of things there that make it seem that there's a very open communication, you know, environment, where if a young engineer is seeing something that he maybe doesn't think anyone else is seeing, or just what we call kind of push-pull communications. I'm seeing this, just, you know, letting you know so that you've got the information at hand. Would that be fair to say? Very open, honest, courageous kind of.
Absolutely. So there's an awful lot of that. And as you say, that push-pull is a really good example of, or a good description of how it works. So going back to that sort of race engineer being the center of the hub and owning the room, they will ask the specialist for some advice, but equally they are willing to hear the, you know, advice pushed to them. It just then takes a bit of skill for everyone to listen to what's going on. So we use these you know, huge multi-channel intercom systems. So there's lots going on, lots of different channels. And so you've obviously, when you want to chip in and offer some advice or a suggestion, you've just got to be listening to the background noise and have some empathy with what the race engineer is currently dealing with, and understand whether they're in a position to to receive some new information, or whether actually it's better on balance just to keep quiet.
I loved it. Yeah, I loved it. The military man in me was really excited. You let me listen to a few of the comms going on in the background in the pit, and it really did sound like military speak. Yeah, short, brief, curt, terse. No one takes offense if you butt in, and necessarily so. But it's funny, if the average person heard, the middle of F1 race people talking, they'd go, no, they don't sound too excited, or they're very measured, very moderate. And the same in the military. I've been in some gunfights where on the radio you go, wow, he sounds cold. Like, you know, it does strike you. But I think that's the difference in these environments, the people who can pick through the noise and understand that if they make noise or be emotional, that's just creating issues for everyone else on the channel.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think going back to when you're engineering the car and you're dealing with that intuition and you're trying to make a decision and you start to feel under pressure, once you've made that decision, you then, when you key up on the radio to ask the mechanics to make the changes you wanted, you have to be calm. I'm completely in control of this. At least that's what you want everyone to believe, even if you're not fully, because otherwise it very quickly descends into a bit of chaos. So you have to be like that. All of that, yeah, you're right. All the comms are they're very brief. We do some training with XRAF guys here in the UK to learn how to do some of that communication, particularly to the car, where you really do need to time the message to the driver well and keep it brief but accurate. And I think the other great power is, if in most of the time you come across as quite cold and emotionless, when you actually, something becomes urgent and you all of a sudden you don't sound like that, then that piques the interest of everybody listening. So that's an incredible power, that contrast, and learning to,
of course,
deal with that power is fantastic. You don't want to use it to cry wolf too often, but when you really need it, it's hugely effective.
We talk about routine and critical communications, yeah. and sometimes how a team maybe enters a period of critical communications, which you would characterize as being race time, and the routine is in the build-up. You know, how's everyone going? We've got all your shit sorted out, whatever the comms are. And sometimes the team can enter that critical period not all together, and it's in those kind of overlaps between coming in, you know, going into the immersive event that people can kind of take offense or not get the message. If you're being brief and terse and the team isn't ready for that yet, it kind of leads to a question about, I imagine, you know, you're in all high-performance environments. I think it's fair to say, I don't think anyone, it would be too controversial, that you're picking people at the tops of their games. They have a higher than average view of themselves and their abilities, which is what you want. We want this confidence, and we need that controlled confidence. As an aside, you generally find people with great self-doubt as well because of that. That's the tryout journey they've been on. But how do you manage at the times when there might be a bit of conflict between egos and, you know, and then I could extrapolate that out to drivers? I know we can't talk too much about drivers, but in the egos of the team, how do you manage that? What's some tactics you use, Dave?
Yeah, as everyone will know listening, that is tricky, because as you say, the background that drives those egos at times is exactly what you want from people. You just need to somehow keep it under control, and so I guess when the car's actually on track and you're up against the time constraints and everything, then that you have to fall back to a hierarchy and things have to become instructions.
Great.
And that can be difficult for people to do, because we don't have the sort of, yes, we have a line managerial structure, but it isn't always a kind of rigid military style. You know, when I say jump, you ask how high kind of thing, but we need to be able to snap into that sometimes. Now, once between the sessions, when there's opportunity to have a bit more of a discussion, then it's about hearing everyone's points of view, understanding why people want to do things, because it's not always obvious, and then trying to reason together what the best plan is. And I mean, the drivers are fascinating because they will have very strong ideas of what they want to do, and at the end of the day, anything we want to do with the car, they have to buy into that test we want to do or that approach to something, because if they don't fully buy into it, then that spoils the test, because they don't take it kind of seriously perhaps. So they have a lot of influence and a lot of power in the room. But equally, if you need to take them to one side and kind of have a conversation with them and say, well, I want to put my point of view across again, and this is why I think we should be doing this, then more often than not, they're very open to listening to that.
Between I guess you've got to build a good rapport before. It's a bit like planning and preparing for the mission. You've got to plan and prepare for the relationships and build the social capital.
There's no doubt. I mean, the relationship between the race engineer and the driver has to work. There has to be an enormous amount of trust there both ways, and that can be difficult to do. I mean, I think fortunately for me, with both Jensen and Felipe Massa, I think we had really, really strong relationship. We understood each other extremely well. So when things do get fraught, which inevitably they do at times when the driver's out on track, you can go back to that just pure trust that you've built up with people. But yeah, that is an absolutely critical relationship, and you've really got to work hard at it and understand. Again, it comes back to this emotion. The drivers are that they are very emotional, and they can be difficult to read at times, though equally it can be pretty obvious when they're a bit pissed off as well.
I've seen people. Well, I guess they're the ones that are putting their bacon on the line, and
absolutely,
and it's a remarkable sport in that regard. And you know, that's why we go, isn't it, to watch. That's what holds our fascination. And and building. It's obvious to say, but it's great to hear you articulate that that relationship is something to work on. I speak to, you know, leaders, military commanders, even doctors about building social capital away so that when the time comes, you can burn it, you can spend it.
Yeah.
And trust is this war chest, if you like, of social capital gold coins. And when the shit times come, you've got to share the shit news or get tough, you spend a bit of that capital and people don't mind because they know that it's coming from a good place.
Absolutely. And I think maybe not so much for the drivers, but that same thing applies with the engineering group. And I think when we're away, when we're away at the circuit, you know, they're long days at the track, it's hard work. When you get back to the hotel, a lot of people either just want to go and crash or they want to phone the family or whatever it is, or they'll do some more work. But and that's fine. Individuals have their own ways of coping. But if you can, you know, occasionally during the course of the week we're away, you want to get out for a dinner, a quiet beer in the bar, you know, you can cover so much ground in half an hour over a beer that you don't have to talk about any engineering, anything to do with the race at all. But as you say, you build that capital and that trust, and that is really important, really, really important.
Yeah, beautifully put. I also just want to go back to, I made a note there about this hierarchy in a crisis. I believe this too. And there's in the civilian world, people bristle at, oh, hierarchy, it needs to be flat and everybody's happy campers. But in a crisis, I think that's why high performance teams can adapt to a hierarchy. It's always there in the background. And I like the idea of toggling between, you know, agile or adaptive teams. This is another thing that's kind of thrown around. They're the teams that can toggle between, know when to snap into a hierarchy and then know just when to relax and flatten out. I can't imagine another environment that's more critical at that human tech interface in F1.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think for us, it is really important that we can switch between those two kind of ways of working. So there are definitely times when you do just have to pull together as a team and do it my way kind of thing.
Yeah. What did Richie Beno say? Work as a team and do it my way.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that is absolutely crucial. And it involves the trust that plan we're all embarking on is a good plan. Yeah. And everyone has to buy into it, but there are times when that buy-in just has to be instant. And so that's where you rely on that trust you've built up over a lot of time, which is why I just don't think there's much way to shortcut your way into a kind of high performance team. Certainly in our in our world, you it's all of those shared experiences, good and bad, that embeds that trust. And how you deal with the bad ones probably is a big part of that. But just living it together, and I say particularly when we're away at the track and you are mostly away from your family. And you are together with the team, there's so much kind of more sort of casual bonding you can do there that makes a massive difference. But yeah, that really pays off when someone just will have to say, this is what we're doing. We're doing it now. We're doing it this way. I can give you a brief, briefly, this is why we're doing it and why I think it's the right thing. But we'll talk about it later if people have different views. But at least you need to be able to take people on that journey in the moment. And for the most part, we can do that pretty successfully. But it's definitely difficult when new members join the team. You know, do that when they understand when we've switched between those two modes and maybe their input is not timely right now.
Yeah. That's a great segue there, mate. I imagine being away, the nature of the work, the focus, the intensity, and being away from families and normal support structures, it takes a toll on a young person or a team member. And there's only a certain certain type of person or a bit of luck as well for people to exist a long time in a career. What's a post career look like for someone who's, you know, spent a bit of time in F1 racing and yeah, I'm interested in the drive as well. I don't know how much you could say about that, but their post driving career or post Williams' career for some of these really high-performing individuals?
Yeah, so I mean, with the engineers, I mean,
to meet those highs again, to live those highs. I mean, to go back to work on a Bobcat or something boring. I mean, is that a thing?
I think it is something people do struggle with. I think you know, there's particularly in the engineering world, we are so high paced and particularly at the track, everybody is in that mode. Everyone understands and things. Things get done very quickly, and you can, as we've talked about, rely on that intuition and the environment. As far as I'm aware, in an engineering sense, is really quite unique. And going back to, you know, to industry, if you like, I think would be really difficult. I'm sure I'd find it difficult and frustrating, and not quite sure why we can't do things, you know, more quickly or with a bit more intuition. So arguably, that is a problem for people who want to kind of leave the business or leave the F1 world. But if you've had that experience of the really high paced stuff at the track, then I think that there's a lot of opportunity to bring that experience back to the factory based team, where it still has many of the same traits. We still work to difficult deadlines, but it's not quite as rigid as the track. But the more of the kind of track-based approach we can bring back to the factory, then I think, or at least a select version of it, I think we can drive up the factory performance. There's a lot of opportunity for those high-performing individuals to come back, find a factory-based role in Formula One and make a huge difference. But you still potentially run into that kind of burnout sort of situation. It's really tough, and we've currently, as a sport, you know, we talked earlier about the test teams not existing anymore, and that was an obvious route in the past for people who'd been on the race team, where they maybe take a more senior role, but on the test team, and that breeds that training ground. So the test team ends up being experienced,
yeah,
individuals who've got all the race experience, coupled
the grey
with a load
beards
of,
or the grey exactly, heads, yeah.
But then we run into that problem that we talk about on these team casts about, what's Preston's phrase about being good at a thing doesn't mean certainly doesn't mean you're good at teaching a thing.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So that absolutely becomes a problem or could do. But a lot of what the reason we don't have those test teams anymore as a sport, we do way more races, Grand Prix, than we used to in a season, and many, many more outside of Europe. So when I started, there were maybe only 16 races in the year, and I can't remember exactly. Maybe 10 of those were in Europe. So actually, the time away wasn't so bad. Now there's 24 races in the season, and
that's right. Yeah.
I mean, how many are in Europe? Maybe I can't remember. Eight or something. So that's an awful lot of traveling. The States, Australia, Asia. You know, we go all over the place and backwards and forwards.
I imagine the young folk. That's exciting. And to some degree, you've got to save them from themselves. I found that in the military, guys will just keep going, I want to go, I want to go, I want to go. And you're saying, hey, I get it, but for your own health and well-being and family and everything else, this time you're not. You're going to go and have some time off, and you can almost save them from themselves. Is that something that you're conscious of?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that. I think that's the true both within, you know, we do 3 weeks away on the road for a triple header or, you know, out intercontinental somewhere. And so you need to persuade people to take a day or half a day or whatever it is, just to go and do something and clear their minds and try and get a little bit of, you know, refreshed a little bit. And then between races, yeah, you've got to send these people home, let them spend some time with their family and decompress a bit. But at the same time, you're then faced with the difficulty of it's that trackside team who have all the knowledge about what we need to do to make the car faster. Mm. They're the ones who, they're the owners of that critical information. So although you want them to go and relax and refresh and get ready for the next trip, you also need them to be providing with that information and contributing to the overall program. And that's a real dilemma, how we do that efficiently. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There are times when you do need to save people from themselves and the short immediate term and over a more sort of medium term time frame.
Well, Well, whatever you've been doing, mate, works well, because you did when I met you, when I first met you, you were fresh and energized. I assume that these F1 environments are full of nerds, people who love the cars and love the engines and it's high paced and high performance and very, as I said, a very glamorous kind of sport. So there's lots of attractors. I can see why people stay in it for the long term. As we wrap up, we always like to finish with some advice on what could the team do on Monday. And I'm going to leave that to the audience to feel it. But I was just thinking then, you know, someone who's lasted so long, I mean, it sounds like, you know, 30 plus years in this elite high level, you know, it's arguably the premier sport on the planet. And if it's not, it's in the top, you know, couple or few. And I love it's the tech human interface. I've been accused of being anti-tech and anti-science. I'm certainly not. I'm massive on evidence and tech, but I think there needs to be a balance. And in some parts of the world, I work with corporates. The tech owns the humans. Essentially, it's where. But F1 seems to have this great tension. That's what we want to see. I love that, because it pushes the human and drives the tech for mostly for good. That of course we need to make money, etc. But I was wondering, someone coming into your position, a younger Dave, you know, 10 years younger than you, coming through the system, he's watching you and getting it. You know, what advice have you got for him in terms of professional development, or what he should be focusing on? What are the skills of the future that he needs to become you 10 years in the future, or you know, what were some of the lessons that you learned that would be valuable to him along the way?
Yeah, good question. I think circling back to something we covered earlier on, I think I wish that I had maybe appreciated what constitutes high performance and a high performing individual sooner. I say those things that I always did because I thought they were the right thing to do, but they were kind of coping strategies. I think if people can actually recognize those, and maybe people should even go and just write a list of some of the things they do that they think are coping strategies or a bit mundane, write them down and actually think about what they really are, and maybe, well, do that in the context of reading your book and understand maybe what really constitutes high performance, and even things like, yeah, reading and educating yourself and going for a walk and decompressing for 5 minutes when...
I love it. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my new book talks to that exactly. So do yourself a favor, David. You talked about PD there. So is there any professional development or structured approaches just while you're on that?
I think that's a bit more tricky. I mean, obviously, for people who want to kind of do what I've done, you do need to be strong academically in lots of branches of engineering, or at least, I mean, for me, I would say probably this probably covers everything I've ever done. I'm a bit of a jack of all trades and master of none. You know, part of the reason I got into F1 was that I always loved sport, but I was never really good enough at anything. I was competent, but never good enough at anything to do it to a high level. And the engineering for me is the same. I know a bit about all parts of the car, but I'm not an expert in any of that.
Well, you're doing something right. So,
well, you definitely need that background. Yeah, I need enough knowledge to be able to go and talk to the experts and understand not the detail, but the general reasons why we're doing things or where the opportunity is to do better. And I say, going back to that race engineering role, that's what it's all about. I don't need to fully understand the complicated chemistry of the tires. I just need to understand what I need to get the driver to do to get the most out of them to fulfill this, whatever our goal is, or a qualifying lap or a 20 lap race stint, or whatever it is. And so you absolutely need to have some of that fundamental knowledge. But I think, to me, it is about being able to assimilate that data, turn it quickly into information, if you like, give it some structure, give it some context, and then make a decision. Everything we're about is about immediately, or not immediately, sensibly drawing conclusions and producing an action. I hate those meetings that go on for an hour, and you get to the end, and you think, well, what did we decide? What do we conclude? And so everything at the track has to be about conclusions and actions. And the conclusion might be, we don't know yet, or we can't do anything better. This is with where we sit here today. This is the best we can do, and that's absolutely fine. And equally, in meetings where we go around the room and trying to encourage people when they have nothing to add to say nothing is really difficult. People want to talk, and again, it just burns up time. And so, having that confidence to say everything is exactly as I said yesterday. You know, so we might typically do a fairly lengthy briefing on a Thursday, which is the day before the cars actually hit the track, and then Friday morning we'll have a quick final briefing before we go into action. And if on Friday morning nothing's changed since we went through it Thursday, then I want all those experts to put their hand up and say, nothing's changed, it's exactly as we discussed yesterday, and we'll go and execute it. But people do have a tendency to want to go over it all again in great detail. So that's a skill to learn. Know when to just keep quiet and
love it.
Save the time.
I'm going to pinch that for the for an article. That's very, very well put, mate. I'll finish off with any reading or podcast or anything you've been doing in your own time professionally, or anything of interest that people can add to their reading list. We always get requests for books or articles or podcasts that people are listening to. So if you've got any one or two that kind of stick out for you in recent times that have impacted you?
Yeah, I guess everyone, the vast majority of people listening, will probably read these things, but I do really like Legacy about the All Blacks. There are bits on there I particularly like. I particularly like this sort of sweeping the sheds and people looking after themselves, but there's a lot of good stuff in there. There's a book called The Art of Action by Stephen Bungie, that I think is a really good book. It talks about, in the context of, I think, mostly German and Prussian military history and the way they were organized and tackle problems. And so The Art of Action, that I think is well worth a read. Talks about knowledge gaps and how to close things. And it's quite clearly applicable across all the high performance teams, I think. So there's some pretty good stuff in there. So I'd strongly recommend people read that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, mate, you'll be happy to know the Legacy, it's one of my favourites too, just a very accessible book. I think if you're an operator or, like yourself, the chief of a operation, it impacts at all levels. I was lucky enough to hang out for a week with Tana Amaga, the former All Blacks coach recently in Fiji, and what a ripping bloke. And yeah, it's been a great year for me. I've met some amazing people, including yourself, mate. It's a real privilege to have you on the team cast. So thanks very much for coming on, and hopefully we will see you soon in the new year, either in the UK or here in Melbourne, definitely. And I can't let you go without getting a prediction for the Ashes down under, the cricket, the Ashes this summer. For those Americans listening, it's the biggest sporting competition on the planet, according to me. It's the cricket five test series between England and Australia. Any predictions? Any bold?
Well, it would be certainly be bold to make a prediction. I do think, unusually, that England do have a strong team. We're playing a different breed of test cricket, which I think is really entertaining, and hopefully is going to help keep test cricket alive, because I agree with you. I don't think there's anything better than an Ashes series, but we don't tend to fare all that well when we have to go and play down in your neck of the woods. But I think this summer for you the Ashes series, I think it'll be pretty competitive, and I think England will put up a good fight. So hopefully we'll see some great cricket, and maybe if we see something like 2005 and see not only the great cricket, but I think the great sportsmanship and rivalry between the two teams. But I agree with you. There's nothing better than Ashes down under, and one day I will make it to the MCG to see the Boxing Day test.
Well, I'd warmly invite you along, mate, and we'll do the same in England. I'm going to boldly go 3-2 England, result in every test, I think they'll win it on the last day in Sydney. I just think it's going to be that close this year. We're a little wounded, and you guys are strong. I think India and England test match series recently was superb, probably some of the best cricket I've seen, and that's the kind of preparation you need coming into these things.
Yeah, it's true. We still got to learn to bowl without Kookaburra ball, though. But again, I mean, that's quite a good example of what we were talking about, because as an England bowler, what you can't do is just shrug your shoulders and throw your toys out of the pram and say, this ball's not doing anything. It's the same ball that both teams use, and you've got to get used to it and understand how you do bowl with it in Australian conditions. Brilliant. But hopefully we can do that this year.
Well, I look forward to seeing you around that time. But David, thanks very much for coming on the Teamcast.
Cheers, Harry. Been an absolute pleasure. Good to speak to you.
Thank you again for listening to our Teamcast. For more information about the Mission Critical Team Institute, please go to www.missioncti.com or follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram. If you are a Mission Critical Team that wants more information on our courses, please reach out to our Director of Operations, Janice Jackson, at janice@missioncti.com. That's J-A-N-E-S-E @missioncti.com. And once again, thank you, Janice, and thank you to Shelby Rowe Productions for helping us produce the Teamcast. Have a great day.